Think about the last time you heard a piece of music so beautiful, it essentially paralyzed you.
Oh, yeah, that absolute
You're right.
stillness.
You were sitting there, the final chord rings out, the room just goes totally quiet. And if someone were to walk in right at that second and ask you how you feel, I mean, your brain just flatlines.
It completely shorts out.
Exactly. You have no words. Language suddenly feels like this incredibly blunt, totally useless instrument. Or, you know, think about that bizarre liminal space right before you fall asleep.
Where you aren't really dreaming yet, but you aren't awake either.
Yeah, where the rigid, organized categories of your waking life have just kind of melted away. Or on a much heavier night, think about a grief so profound that the very architecture of your mind seems to collapse.
That is a very real physical sensation.
It really is that silence,
Yeah.
that absolute edge where your normal vocabulary just stops working. That is what we are exploring today.
It is a sensation that sits at the absolute foundation of human experience, honestly. Yet it is almost universally ignored in our day-to-day routines.
Because we just don't have time for it, right?
Right. I mean, we are so busy operating within our constructed realities, checking things off lists, that we rarely acknowledge the sensation of running out of road. But reaching the edge of what the human mind can actually hold or describe is not a malfunction.
Which is such a relief to hear.
It is. According to the source material we are looking at today, it is actually the defining characteristic of consciousness.
And our guide into this territory is this fascinating genre-bending philosophical paper by C.F. Dietz. It is titled The Search for M Consciousness at the Boundary of What Can Be.
A very ambitious title.
Super ambitious. And our mission for this deep dive is to unpack this paper because it isn't just like an abstract logic puzzle meant for some dusty academic journal. It is a direct invitation to you, the listener, to recognize a structural reality you are participating in every single day.
Whether you realize it or not.
Exactly. I mean, we all know that search for meaning, right? Viktor Frankl made that phrase culturally ubiquitous. But Dietz argues there is a deeper, older, far more foundational search beneath that.
The search for M.
The search for M.
And to even begin grasping what Dietz means by M, we have to start by clearing away a tremendous amount of cognitive baggage.
Oh, absolutely. Because when people hear about a profound, unnameable something at the edge of human experience, the immediate reflex is to just map it onto pre-existing concepts. We want to domesticate the unknown.
Because the human brain hates a vacuum. If there is a mystery, we want to slap a label on it so we can put it on a shelf and, stop worrying about
And
it.
you want to sleep at night.
Exactly. That is the literal function of our cognitive machinery. So the text goes to great lengths to establish what M is not. First and foremost, M is not God.
Right. Let's make that clear right up front.
It is not a theological entity with a personality waiting to be prayed to or bargained with. It is also not the universe in a strictly physical, materialistic sense.
Like it's not just a bunch of atoms doing stuff.
Right. And it is not the Freudian unconscious where repressed memories of your childhood are hiding.
And for the scientifically minded listener out there, Dietz makes a point to say it is not a cosmological constant either, which I think is a really crucial distinction to make.
It is entirely crucial because in astrophysics, something like dark matter or dark energy functions as a placeholder.
Like a giant mathematical sticky note.
Yes. It basically says, we do not know how this equation balances yet, so just put this variable here until our telescopes get better.
Until we can figure it out.
Right. That is a fundamental difference in methodology. A cosmological constant is a gap in our current understanding that we fully expect to close one day. Science assumes the gap is temporary.
But Dietz's concept of M is absolutely not that. Dietz defines M as the inexhaustible ground of the world. It is the unavoidable structural reality that human understanding, by its very biological and cognitive nature, is finite.
Yes, and that is the core friction. Every theory, every vocabulary, every framework we use to make sense of reality has an edge. But the world itself, the raw material of existence, is not finite.
It is completely inexhaustible.
It is. So whenever you hit the edge of what your words, your scientific theories, or your emotional categories can successfully process, you feel a pressure pushing back from the other side.
It physically pushes back.
Yeah, that pressure, that sheer inexhaustibility that refuses to be categorized is M.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if M cannot be named, if it fundamentally resists being captured in a theory or a religious dogma or a scientific equation, how on earth do we actually interact with it?
That is the big question.
Right. And why does Dietz claim that navigating this boundary is the most fundamental activity of being alive.
Well, Dietz approaches this by giving us a cast of characters, basically. He outlines three philosophical archetypes to represent the different postures conscious beings take when they stand at that boundary and look out at him.
He calls them John, Bob, and Soren.
Right.
Let us start with John. John is the honest materialist. John looks out at the cosmos. He looks at evolutionary biology, and he sees matter in motion.
Just cold, hard facts.
Yeah. He sees energy transforming over billions of years. He sees complexity arising from simple, unguided processes, but he does not see any grand cosmic purpose woven into the fabric of reality.
To John, meaning is just a localized evolutionary fiction.
A survival tool.
Exactly. It is a psychological trip that helped early hominids cooperate and survive, but it is not a law of physics.
But what is vital here, and I love how Dietz frames this, is John's psychological state. Mm. Because the common trope is that if you do not believe the universe has inherent meaning, you must be a miserable nihilist paralyzed by despair.
Hiding in a corner somewhere.
Right. But John lives incredibly well. He loves his children. He finds deep, genuine satisfaction in his career.
The defining characteristic of John is his refusal to flinch. He refuses to dress the universe up in a significance it simply does not possess.
He assigns meaning to his life, sure, but he does so with a clear-eyed understanding that this meaning is entirely his own creation. It rests on nothing deeper than his own human preference and biological wiring.
He is a pragmatist through and through. He basically says, the universe is indifferent, but I prefer a warm house to a cold one. And I prefer my family to be happy, so I will act accordingly.
Okay, so that is John. But then, completely opposite to John, we have Bob. And Bob is what Dietz calls the lived believer.
Now, Bob might not be religious in an organized institutional sense, but Bob feels, deep in his bones, that the universe is not indifferent.
He feels it. To Bob, the fact that there is something rather than nothing feels entirely intentional. When Bob falls in love, he feels absolute certainty that love is a fundamental structural force of the universe.
Not just a cocktail of oxytocin and dopamine in his brain.
Exactly. And when he sees a breathtaking landscape, beauty is a direct signal to him, not just an accidental sensory response.
And Bob's position is just as structurally common as John's.
Oh, totally.
Bob knows he cannot prove any of this in a laboratory. But to Bob, the phenomenological feeling of meaning is too highly structured, too persistent, and too deeply woven into his moments of greatest clarity to be dismissed as mere evolutionary wishful thinking.
He trusts the feeling.
He does. He holds this not as a logical, deductive argument, but as a lived conviction. He feels the ocean of M, and he just assumes the ocean possesses a personality that cares about him.
So we have John, who looks at M and sees a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob, who looks at M and sees a cosmic author.
Yeah.
And then we get to our third archetype, Soren. Named, obviously, after the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard.
Right.
Soren looks at John and Bob, and he realizes something that neither of them realize about themselves. Both of these men are leaping.
That is the pivotal insight of this whole section, because it is very easy for a modern, secular audience to look at Bob and say, well, obviously, Bob is taking a leap of faith. He is projecting a narrative onto an indifferent reality.
Right. Bob is the crazy one.
Yeah, but Soren's insight is that John is taking a leap, too.
Okay, I am trying to picture how this actually works in real time. It is almost like, you know those Magic Eye posters from the 1990s?
Oh, wow, yes. The ones that just look like chaotic, colorful, static until you relax your eyes and suddenly a 3D image pops out.
Wow. Exactly. A very fitting artifact for this discussion, I think.
How are you applying it here?
So John is staring at the poster, and he says, look, I am being scientifically honest here. The reality here is just random drops of ink on paper. Any 3D image you think you see is just a biological illusion generated by your brain's pattern recognition software misfiring.
Very John thing to say.
Very John. Now, Bob looks at the exact same poster, crosses his eyes, and says, no, John, the universe organized these dots specifically so I could see this beautiful 3D sailboat. The sailboat is the ultimate truth of the poster.
And Soren's position.
Soren looks at the poster, sees the static, crosses his eyes, sees the sailboat, and says, John, you are right. The ink is just ink, and the ink does not care about sailboats at all. But Bob, I am going to choose to inhabit the reality of the sailboat anyway.
It's a conscious choice.
Right. But reading this, I have to admit, I found myself getting a bit frustrated with Soren. I mean, isn't Soren basically just Bob, but with a philosophy degree? Functionally, he ends up in the exact same place as Bob. He is living in the sailboat.
The behavioral outcome might look similar from the outside, sure, but the internal architecture of his reality is profoundly different. And Dietz would argue that internal architecture is everything.
Okay, how so?
The crucial difference lies in awareness and responsibility. Soren knows that his choice to see the sailboat, his choice to inhabit a world of meaning, is a constitutive act. He knows he is consciously building a grammar.
A grammar. Yeah, that word is doing a lot of heavy lifting in this text. We should probably define it for the listener before we go much further.
In Dietz's framework, a grammar means a system for understanding the world. It is the set of rules, categories, and assumptions you use to process raw reality into a coherent narrative.
So it's a filter.
Essentially, yes. Science is a grammar. Religion is a grammar. Economics is a grammar. Soren does not blame the universe for the meaning he experiences the way Bob does.
He doesn't think the poster magically intended for him to see the sailboat.
No, but, and this is where he splits from John, he also does not declare that the grammar of meaningless matter is the absolute final truth of the inexhaustible ground.
I think I am getting it. John leaps into the grammar of materialistic indifference and calls it solid ground.
Right.
Bob leaps into the grammar of cosmic meaning and calls it a divine signal. Both of them think M, the inexhaustible reality, has validated their specific viewpoint. But Soren knows that M does not validate any grammar. M simply is.
Precisely. Soren takes full responsibility for his leap. He owns the creation of that meaning entirely without requiring the universe to co-sign it.
That takes a lot of mental fortitude.
It really does. Mm-hmm. And what makes this triad so compelling is that Dietz isn't just classifying other people, he's just classifying the listener. We are constantly cycling through all three of these archetypes ourselves.
Oh, without a doubt. I was thinking about this yesterday. You might be John on a Tuesday morning when you are stuck in traffic, you spill coffee on yourself, and you think, yep, the universe is just a meat grinder of random physics and chaos.
We've all been there.
Right. Then on Thursday, you are Bob, holding a newborn baby or standing in front of the ocean, and you are overwhelmed with the absolute, unshakable certainty that life has profound significance.
And maybe on Sunday, after reading a dense book, you are Soren, realizing that you are just constantly swapping out the lenses through which you view M.
It highlights the extreme fluidity of human consciousness. We are continuously adjusting our grammars to manage our encounter with the inexhaustible.
But Dietz doesn't just leave us with these broad archetypes. He actually drills down into the specific mechanical vocabulary of how this encounter happens. He introduces what he calls the closure framework.
Yes, the closure framework. This involves the distinction between capital M, lowercase m, and c.
Let us get into the machinery of this. We know capital M is the inexhaustible ground, the raw, unnameable reality. But Dietz introduces lowercase m, which he calls the felt interior.
I found this description incredibly visceral. Lowercase m is what it is like to be you from the inside right at this exact second.
In the philosophy of mind, this is often referred to as phenomenological interiority. Thomas Nagel wrote a famous paper called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? Arguing that there is a specific subjective feeling to being a bat that can never be captured by a third-person scientific description of a bat's brain.
You can't put it in a spreadsheet.
You can't. Lowercase m is that subjective feeling.
And Dietz uses such everyday examples to ground it, which I really appreciated. Lowercase m is the raw, piercing redness of a stop sign. It is the physical, hollow ache of longing in your chest.
Or the distinct difference between how a Tuesday feels and how a Saturday feels.
Yes. Even if you have the exact same schedule on both days, you wake up and the air just feels like a Saturday. You cannot put that Saturday feeling under a microscope. Our neurologists cannot find the Saturday feeling in an fMRI scan.
No, they can't.
But it is undeniably, overwhelmingly real to you.
The text underscores a tragic beauty inherent in lowercase m, though. It is absolutely isolated.
It's so lonely.
It is. No matter how much someone loves you, no matter how articulate you are in describing your feelings, nobody else has direct access to your M. When you listen to that beautiful piece of music you mentioned in the introduction and you feel paralyzed by it, the person sitting next to you might also be moved, but their M is entirely their own.
Your internal experience is a locked room.
Yes. So we have capital M, the inexhaustible world outside. We have lowercase m, your totally private felt experience on the inside. And then Dietz introduces C, which stands for cognitive closure.
Right. Think of C as the cognitive machinery that shapes the raw feeling of M. It is the biological and mental architecture that projects futures, remembers the past, holds spatial relationships, and essentially constitutes your coherent reality.
Exactly. If lowercase m is the raw, unnameable feeling of a Saturday, C is the mental structure that knows a Saturday comes after a Friday, remembers what you did last Saturday, and is anxious about the work you have to do on Monday.
So C is the thing building the grammars. It takes the raw feeling and builds a house for it.
To pull all three of these together, capital M, lowercase m, and C dites, introduces a metaphor that becomes the anchor for the rest of the paper. Capital M is the ocean. Lowercase m is a specific wave on that ocean.
This is such a powerful image. It is an incredibly precise structural analogy. Visualize a wave swelling out in the deep water. As it moves and rises, that wave is a completely real entity.
It has measurable height, it has kinetic force, it can knock a boat over.
It is a specific, unique shape, a localized closure that has never existed before and will never exist again in exactly that configuration.
But the wave is temporary. Eventually, it hits the shore, or the wind dies down and the wave breaks. It flattens out, the white water fizzes away, and the wave dissolves entirely back into the water.
Yes, and notice what happens when it dissolves. The wave is not destroyed in the sense of vanishing into non-existence. It is returned to the inexhaustible ground it was made of.
The wave was never actually separate from the ocean. It was a temporary, structured expression of the ocean, held together by the specific forces acting on it at that moment.
So lowercase m, your specific, momentary, internal experience of being alive, is that wave. Capital M is the vast ocean it rises from.
Okay, I need to throw a massive red flag here, though.
Oh, let's hear it.
Because as I was reading this section, a foundational contradiction kept bothering me. I was waiting for Deitz to address it, and I want to see how you interpret this. We have established that capital M, the ocean, is completely inexhaustible. It is unnameable. It actively exceeds every single grammar, every category, and every word we have.
Right.
So isn't Deitz completely contradicting himself by writing a 20-page, highly structured academic paper where he literally assigns a letter M to the unnameable? By trying to define it with metaphors about oceans and waves, hasn't he just built another grammar? He's doing exactly what he says we shouldn't do.
That is a very sharp critique, and I thought the exact same thing. And if Deitz were claiming to have successfully captured M, you would be entirely correct. It would be a fatal contradiction.
Right.
But look at the author's notes toward the end of the text. Deitz explicitly anticipates this paradox. He concedes that naming it M does not capture it. The paper itself is not a net designed to catch the unnameable. He describes the paper as an act of pointing.
Pointing? But doesn't putting up a signpost still trick the brain into thinking the thing we are pointing at is a known entity? Aren't we just giving the brain a new grammar to hide behind? Like, oh, don't worry about the infinite terror of the universe. It's just M.
It certainly risks that, which is why the text emphasizes the friction of the boundary. Deitz uses the analogy of ancient map makers.
Okay.
When they drew a map of the known world and reached the edge of their geographical grammar, they didn't just leave it blank, but they also didn't pretend they knew what was there. They drew a boundary line and wrote, "Here be dragons."
Ah, I see.
Putting that signpost on the map didn't mean they had scientifically cataloged dragons. It didn't bring the unknown into the realm of the known. It was a structural acknowledgement of the limit of their grammar. It was a way of saying, our vocabulary ends here, but reality keeps going.
I get it. It is like trying to use a flashlight to examine the dark. The very tool you are using changes the thing you're trying to observe because now it is illuminated, but you still have to acknowledge that the dark exists just beyond the beam.
Exactly. Deitz hasn't captured the inexhaustible ground. He has just given us a vocabulary to talk about the fact that we are standing at the edge of it.
He is mapping the boundary, not the territory beyond it.
Right. Now, this idea of the wave and its temporary existence leads directly into a question Deitz wrestles with heavily. If M, the ocean, is totally indifferent and unnameable, and if lowercase m, the wave, is just our temporary internal biological feeling, where does meaning actually come from?
Because we all feel meaning. It is undeniable.
We do. This is where Deitz synthesizes the positions of our three archetypes, John, Bob, and Soren, into a mechanical explanation. He argues that meaning is absolutely not located in capital M.
The ocean itself does not care about you. There is no cosmic ledger keeping score of your moral choices. On this point, John, the materialist is structurally correct.
Right. But meaning is also not entirely contained, just in lowercase m.
Yeah.
Bob is wrong to think that just because he feels a sense of cosmic destiny when he meets his partner, it proves the universe mathematically orchestrated his relationship from the Big Bang.
Correct. Bob is confusing the internal, intense feeling of the wave with the fundamental nature of the ocean. The feeling of meaning is profoundly real to Bob as an internal state, but it is not empirical evidence that the universe itself is generating that meaning.
So if meaning is not in the ocean, and it is not just a solipsistic hallucination of the wave, where does it live?
Dietz argues that meaning arises exclusively in the contact between the two.
A contact point, the boundary.
Yes. Meaning arises in the active encounter between lowercase m and capital M.
Yeah.
Between your felt interior and the inexhaustible ground it is pressing up against.
So it's a verb, almost.
Exactly. Meaning is what Dietz calls constituted. It is held inside a living closure, inside your consciousness. It is totally objectively real, but it is only real for as long as that specific conscious closure exists to hold it.
And here is where the text takes a turn that I found incredibly affecting. It takes this highly abstract, phenomenological concept of constitution and contact and applies it directly to the anatomy of grief.
It is the most powerful application of his framework.
It really is.
Yeah.
It explains why losing someone literally feels like the world is ending. It strips away the platitudes we normally use around death and provides a structural mechanics for the pain.
I really want to walk the listener through this slowly because it changed how I think about loss.
Let's do it.
Why does grief feel the way it does? According to Dietz, it is not just the psychological experience of missing a person. It is not just sadness that you won't see them again. Grief is the literal dissolution of the specific lowercase m that held the meaning of that person.
Let us trace the mechanics of that. When you love someone deeply, your cognitive closure, your C, builds a massive, intricate structure. A highly specific wave of M rises up, and that wave is your relationship to them.
It's made of all the little details.
Right. That wave contains all your shared vocabulary, the specific way your day felt when you knew they were coming home, the way they challenged your ideas. That entire phenomenological reality is a unique wave arising from the ocean.
And when that person dies, or even when a profound relationship ends irrevocably, the external condition that sustained that wave vanishes. That specific wave literally cannot exist anymore.
It breaks.
The closure that knew them from the inside is irrevocably shattered. And this is the crucial part that explains the overwhelming despair of grief. The meaning that was held in that relationship didn't just relocate to a memory bank in your brain.
The specific felt interior reality of that relationship dissolves. And the meaning that was constituted in that contact point dissolves back into the inexhaustible ground of capital M.
It returns to the ocean. When you are deep in the initial shock of grief, it feels like everything you valued has been annihilated.
Like your meaning has been thrown into a black hole, and you are just left with this terrifying emptiness.
But Dietz is saying, no, it is not nothingness. It feels like nothingness because your grammar broke. But the ocean was always there, even when the wave was the only thing you were paying attention to.
The meaning didn't vanish into a void. The wave just returned to the exact material it was always made of.
Now, obviously, it does not erase the pain. The text is very clear that the dissolution of a closure is agonizing. The wave is truly gone. You cannot get that specific configuration back.
But it provides a structural truth to the experience. It honors the reality of the loss without defaulting to nihilism. The ground from which that beautiful wave arose is inexhaustible. It is still there.
It shifts the perspective from a permanent, terrifying absence to a profound return.
And this idea of hitting the boundary of M, of having your normal world, your grammars, violently stripped away, leads us into the second half of the paper. Dietz moves from theoretical mechanics to profiling 8 specific historical searches.
He looks at real people who hit the absolute boundary of what their grammars could handle.
He uses these historical figures as empirical case studies for the philosophical framework. And he begins with perhaps the most extreme example of human extremity imaginable, Viktor Frankl.
Right. Viktor Frankl, the psychiatrist who wrote Man's Search for Meaning after surviving the Nazi concentration camps.
If we use Dietz's vocabulary, Frankl was forced into an environment where every single external grammar was systematically, brutally stripped away from him. His professional identity as a doctor, erased. His family, murdered. Any concept of a predictable future, gone.
Even the basic biological dignity of his physical body was stripped away by starvation and violence.
In the camps, Frankl was shoved violently against the absolute terrifying boundary of capital M. The universe, as presented to him in that horrific context, was not just indifferent, it was actively hostile.
If meaning is something you find out in the world, Frankl was in a place where no meaning existed. There was no pre-existing cosmic justice hiding in the mud of Auschwitz.
So mechanically, within the closure framework, what did he actually do? Did he just retreat into his memories and ignore the reality of M?
It is the exact opposite. He didn't ignore M, he pressed against it. Dietz points out that Frankl didn't discover a meaning that was waiting to be found. He constituted it.
From scratch.
From scratch. He used the absolute last remaining resource he had, his lowercase m, his internal conscious reality, and he pressed it against that horrifying boundary.
He visualized his wife's face in the freezing cold. He made the conscious, agonizing internal decision to try and offer a piece of bread to a dying prisoner. He committed to observing the psychological state of the guards so he could bear witness later.
She generated the meaning from the inside out. He used his cognitive closure to build a microgrammar of meaning in a place where all macrogrammars had been destroyed.
Yes, these were constitutive acts. Yep. Frankl proved that the capacity to constitute meaning is, as he famously called it, the last human freedom.
Even when every single external freedom is violently taken, the internal wave of consciousness can still choose the posture it takes as it meets the ocean.
But Dietz adds a crucial layer here. Frankl's search for meaning was successful. It didn't collapse into delusion, precisely because it was conducted upon the deeper ground of M.
He wasn't pretending the horror wasn't there. He was in genuine contact with the unnameable horror, and he chose to constitute meaning right on that boundary.
And now, from Frankl's unimaginable trauma, Dietz pivots to someone who approached the boundary from a very different, deeply philosophical angle. Albert Camus.
The philosopher who championed the concept of the absurd.
Exactly. Camus is a vital inclusion because he takes John's position, the honest materialist view that the universe is completely indifferent, and pushes it to its absolute logical extreme, but arrives at a completely different emotional outcome.
Camus looks at M and says, "The universe is completely silent. It does not care about our desperate biological need for meaning and narrative."
That violent clash between our desire for purpose and the universe's absolute silence is what he calls the absurd. And he uses the Greek myth of Sisyphus to illustrate this.
Sisyphus is the king condemned by the gods to roll a massive boulder up a mountain for all eternity, only for the boulder to roll back down the moment he reaches the peak. Completely pointless, agonizing labor forever.
It is the ultimate metaphor for the futility of human endeavor in a meaningless universe. But then Camus executes this brilliant philosophical maneuver. He says, "We must imagine Sisyphus happy."
Which sounds deeply counterintuitive. Why on earth would he be happy? He is in hell.
Because, as Dietz explains through his framework, Camus realizes that the meaning isn't in the boulder, and it isn't in the mountain. The pushing is ours.
By staring directly at the total indifference of M, Camus does not collapse into despair. He constitutes meaning in full defiance of that indifference.
The wave, Sisyphus, doesn't need the ocean's permission to be a wave. The very act of pushing the boulder is a radical affirmation of his own existence. He looks at the meaningless ground and says, "I am going to live anyway."
So if I'm understanding this, Camus isn't finding meaning underneath the rock. He is forging it in the physical act of pushing.
Precisely. John looks at the meaningless universe and says, "Oh, well, nothing matters, but I'll make the best of it." Camus looks at it and says, "Nothing matters. Therefore, the fact that I am here rebelling against that nothingness is the ultimate expression of freedom."
It is a fiery, passionate, constitutive act of defiance. It is meaning as rebellion. It is a posture that accepts the inexhaustible ground without demanding it be comforting.
Okay, so we have Frankl in extreme trauma, Camus in philosophical rebellion, but then Dietz introduces Albert Einstein.
Which is quite the pivot.
Right. And when I first saw the name, I had a moment of cognitive dissonance. Surely Einstein wasn't leaping like Kierkegaard or rebelling like Camus. Einstein was about mathematics, empirical data, and provable physics. He wasn't dealing with the unnameable. He was dealing with the highly specific.
It seems out of place until you understand how Dietz defines the epistemological edge of science. Dietz anchors this section in a famous quote from Einstein. "The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science."
People love to put that quote on inspirational posters.
They do. Treating it like Einstein was just being poetic after a long day of doing hard math, like a romantic side note.
But Dietz argues Einstein was describing his literal methodology. Think about how scientific paradigms actually shift. You have an existing theory, a grammar, that explains how gravity or light works. Newtonian physics, for example.
It works perfectly for hundreds of years.
But eventually, as measurements get more precise, the theory starts generating what Dietz calls remainder, little anomalies. Data points that the math cannot explain, The orbit of Mercury doesn't quite fit. The speed of light acts weirdly.
It is the friction. It is the moment the mapmaker reaches the edge and has to write, "Here be dragons."
Exactly. For a dogmatic thinker, that anomaly is an error, something to be smoothed over or ignored to protect the grammar. For Einstein, that friction, that pressure from the inexhaustible M pushing against the current scientific grammar, was the very tool he used to break the old grammar and build a new one.
He didn't retreat from the mystery. He used the encounter with the unnameable to force supersession, to create relativity. But Einstein's approach only works if you can build a new math to contain the mystery. He used the friction to build a bigger box. But he did that knowing full well that eventually relativity would hit the boundary of M too.
Precisely. Einstein knew he wasn't solving M. He knew his new equations would eventually generate their own remainder, their own anomalies. The search wouldn't end.
Mystery wasn't a failure of his science. It was the engine of it. He deliberately worked right at the boundary where the math broke down.
That completely reframes the scientific enterprise. It is not about building a final box that contains the whole universe. It is about building progressively more accurate boxes that allow us to stand closer to the infinite without losing our minds.
But what happens when you hit a boundary where numbers and language completely disintegrate? Where you can't build a bigger box? That is the wall the mystics hit.
And that is exactly where Deitz takes us next. How do we deal with M when our cognitive machinery, our C, simply cannot process the encounter? Deitz introduces the 13th century Sufi mystic and poet Rumi. In Deitz's framework, Rumi represents what happens when lowercase m touches capital M with such intense, overwhelming force that the boundary between the wave and the ocean becomes entirely transparent.
Deitz is very careful here to examine Rumi phenomenologically, not theologically. He is not validating Islamic mysticism. He is looking at the experience Rumi is constantly trying to describe.
Rumi writes obsessively about the beloved. In the closure framework, this state is called radical permeability. The conscious closure, the wave, is pressed against the inexhaustible ground so hard that the ocean actually floods into the wave.
Let's pause on that phrase, flooding. What does that literally mean in terms of consciousness? Are we saying the human mind just short circuits?
It is an ecstatic short circuit. The normal cognitive functions, the ego, the sense of separate self, the internal monologue, are overwhelmed by the sheer presence of the inexhaustible ground.
The structure of doesn't dissolve entirely into death, but it loses its rigid borders. The inside and the outside become indistinguishable.
It is not just a nice idea to Rumi. It is a permanent reorganization of his reality. When Rumi writes his ecstatic poetry, he is trying to leave a record of what it physically and mentally felt like to have his internal world flooded by the infinite. The wave was changed forever by feeling the ocean from the inside.
But that level of ecstatic flooding is not the only way to navigate the failure of language. Deitz contrasts Rumi's ecstasy with the philosopher Simone Weil. Weil approached this boundary not through passionate poetry, but through a concept she called attention.
This might be the most countercultural concept in the whole paper.
Without a doubt.
Because Weil's idea of attention isn't what we usually mean when we use that word today. Usually when someone says pay attention, they mean focus your brain on this specific problem so you can solve it and close the loop. Is an aggressive, grasping kind of focus.
But Weil means something completely different. She means waiting.
She means holding the self open without trying to fill the emptiness. Being present at the boundary without immediately grasping for a grammar to hold on to.
I was trying to picture what this posture actually feels like, and I stumbled on an analogy. It is like sitting on your back porch late at night in the pitch black. You know there are things out there in the woods.
Right.
You leave the back door unlocked. But you deliberately refuse to turn on the harsh security floodlights. You aren't sitting there with a flashlight hunting for a specific deer or raccoon. You aren't problem solving. You are just sitting in the dark, maximizing your openness to whatever happens to cross the boundary of the yard. You are just, you know, radically available.
That analogy perfectly captures the phenomenological state Deitz is describing. Weil believed that the soul's capacity to wait in the dark without turning on the floodlights, without grasping for a premature answer or a comforting grammar, is itself the highest form of contact with M.
Attention without grasping is the posture of a conscious being becoming maximally permeable to M without losing its shape. You are holding the wave at its absolute most open configuration, refusing to let it crash.
It takes so much discipline to not turn on the floodlight. We are so biologically and culturally conditioned to want to define things immediately, which is the perfect transition to the next figure, Ludwig Wittgenstein. the philosopher who literally tried to mathematically prove that we need to stop talking about the unnameable.
Wittgenstein is a titan of 20th century philosophy. He wrote a book called the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which is essentially a massive, highly technical attempt to define exactly what language can and cannot do.
He wanted to draw a hard mathematical line around what can be spoken about meaningfully. And he ends the book with one of the most famous quotes in the history of philosophy.
Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent.
He was pointing directly at the boundary of M. He was saying, look, our language is a finite grammar. It has strict logical limits. When we hit the edge of those limits, when we encounter the inexhaustible, we shouldn't babble on and pretend our words are still making sense. We should recognize the boundary, accept the failure of the grammar, and respect it with silence.
But the irony that Dietz highlights here is just agonizingly funny and sad at the same time. Wittgenstein wrote that famous line, told all the other philosophers to shut up about the unnameable, declared the problem of philosophy solved, and then what did he do?
He spent the rest of his entire life writing books, giving lectures, agonizing over language, and filling notebooks, talking about the very thing he said we must be silent about.
He couldn't help himself. He literally couldn't stay silent. And Dietz uses this as the ultimate proof of his thesis. No conscious being can.
Wittgenstein's entire agonizing career demonstrates that the search for M cannot be completed, but it also cannot be abandoned. The silence isn't a final destination where you can just rest. We are structurally compelled to press against a boundary to try and speak the unspeakable, even when we know mathematically that our words will fail.
We have talked about brilliant psychiatrists, rebellious philosophers, genius physicists, ecstatic mystics, but Dietz concludes the paper by introducing one final searcher, one final figure standing at the boundary. And it is none of those exceptional things. Dietz strips away all the romance and all the intellect and presents us with simply the patient alone.
This is where the abstract philosophy is brought down to the most naked, vulnerable, unmediated human experience possible. It is the emotional climax of the text. Dietz describes a scene, a patient sitting alone in a small, sterile clinic room right after receiving a devastating, life-altering medical diagnosis.
Let us really slow down and visualize the sensory reality of this room. The fluorescent lights are buzzing overhead. The doctor has just delivered the news. Maybe it is terminal. Maybe it is a chronic degenerative condition. And the doctor has stepped out to give the patient a minute to process.
The air in the room suddenly feels incredibly heavy. The temperature seems to drop.
Right.
This patient isn't a philosopher. They don't have a vocabulary of closures and grammars and remainder and phenomenology.
But mechanically, they're doing exactly what every philosopher in this paper has done. And the mechanics of the tragedy in that room are incredibly precise. The boundary of M didn't wait to be sought out on a mountaintop or in an equation. It invaded the room.
The reality of the inexhaustible ground, the chaos of biology, the total lack of narrative control, the sheer, indifferent force of mortality has shattered the door.
And what does the patient do in that silence? Walk me through the psychological breakdown of that moment. How does a grammar actually fail in real time?
They do what human beings are biologically wired to do. They reach desperately for every single grammar they've spent their life building to try and close the gap and make the room make sense again.
They reach for medical statistics. What is the survival rate? What is the treatment plan?
They reach for their religious grammar. Why is God doing this to me? I am a good person.
They reach for their past psychological coping skills. I beat the odds before. I am a fighter. I can handle this.
And in that moment, in the immediate aftermath of the shock, they find that M simply exceeds all of them.
Yes. The statistics don't comfort the visceral existential dread in their stomach. The prayers seem to bounce off the acoustic ceiling tiles. The personal narrative of being a fighter feels hollow in the face of microscopic cellular replication. The boundary is terrifyingly, overwhelmingly real.
The grammar they've written their entire life inside, the grammar where they would grow old, see their kids graduate, retire, is suddenly entirely insufficient to model the reality that is now present in the room.
It is the search for M in its absolute most naked, unromanticized form.
And I want to emphasize this directly to you, the listener. You do not need a PhD to encounter M. You don't need to go on a silent meditation retreat for 10 years or survive a historical atrocity. Life, just the basic structural reality of being a fragile biological creature in an infinite universe, will eventually force the encounter. The boundary will come to you. Your grammars will break.
And when they do, Dietz wants us to recognize that the patient in that room is conducting the exact same fundamental activity as Viktor Frankl in the mud of the camps, or Albert Einstein staring at anomalies on his chalkboard, or Simone Weil waiting in the dark.
They're searching for a way to be in the presence of what cannot be closed. It is the core defining activity of conscious life.
Which brings us to our final takeaway. As we synthesize this incredibly dense deep dive, let's summarize the core realization of Dietz's framework. The search for M will never end.
It mathematically cannot end because M, the inexhaustible ground of reality, cannot be captured by a finite mind. But unlike searching for meaning in a completely indifferent universe, the search for M has a real object.
That is the pivotal distinction that separates this from nihilism. M is really there. John thinks there is nothing out there to search for, just dead matter. Bob searches for a cosmic narrative that isn't actually there. But Soren, the aware leaper, and Frankel and Camus and the patient in the room, they are encountering something real.
The pressure you feel when words fail is a real pressure. It is not an illusion.
It is the structural reality of what you are, interacting with what the world is. The wave touching the ocean.
And I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over today. Something that builds on Dietz's beautiful metaphors, but perhaps takes them a step further into how we relate to each other.
Let's hear it.
If every single one of us is just a specific, incredibly unique wave of lowercase m, rising up, experiencing the world, suffering, loving, and eventually dissolving back into the exact same inexhaustible ocean of capital M, maybe the way we think about human connection is slightly off.
In what way?
Maybe the most profound moments of connection we experience with other people aren't when our waves crash into each other in the busy, noisy, conversational surface of life. Maybe the truest, deepest connection happens at those rare boundaries.
When the wave flattens out a bit?
Yeah. In shared, unspeakable grief, where no one tries to offer a platitude. In the silence after a beautiful piece of music. In those moments where we both run out of words, look at each other, and briefly recognize that beneath the temporary, fragile shape of our individual lives, we are made of the exact same water.
A profound synthesis of the material. The boundary is where our grammars fail, but it is also where we are most fully alive and perhaps most fundamentally connected to one another.
So today, as you go about your routine, try to pay attention to the edge of your own grammars. Notice the moments when your words fail, when your frustration mounts because reality isn't fitting into your box. And instead of rushing to fill the silence or fix the anomaly, just feel the pressure of the ocean pushing back. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We will catch you on the next one.